The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Omni shambles. Theresa May loses her second Brexit secretary and three other ministers as her divorce deal is lambasted from all sides. And goodbye Mary Lou. Pádraig Tobin walks away from Sinn Féin. That's all coming up on tonight's Late Debate. But first the news with Eileen Whelan. Thanks, Eileen, and good evening and welcome to The Late Debate with Katie Hannan. Joining us in studio tonight, we have Fine Gael Senator Neil Richmond, Fianna Fáil Councillor Paul McAuliffe, John O'Brien of the Maynooth University Centre for European and Eurasian Studies, and Harry McGee, the political correspondent for The Irish Times. And we will shortly be joined by Lucinda Creighton, CEO of Vulcan Consulting, and of course, the former Minister for European Affairs. Now, it has been... Oh, we want to hear from you. So please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_rte. Now, it's been another extraordinary day in Brexit land.
But one simple fact remains, and that is that nobody has produced any alternative proposal which both delivers on the referendum and also ensures that there's no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. There's another inescapable fact. There is no deal which can be agreed with the European Union that does not involve a backstop to act as an insurance policy against a return to the borders of the past.
The Conservative Party is lucky to be full of talent, and there are many, many people. Who do you want me to start with? You've got Boris Johnson and David Davis, and you've got Dominic Raab and Esther McVeigh, you've got Penny Morden. You have streams of talent within the Conservative Party who would be very capable of support of leading a proper Brexit.
The choice is now clear. We stand up for the United Kingdom, the whole of the United Kingdom, the integrity of the United Kingdom, or we vote for a vassal state with the breakup of the United Kingdom. That's the choice.
Under pressure. Under pressure. Pressure.
Under pressure. It sure is a pressure cooker atmosphere in London this evening. Let's go straight away to John Rentall, the chief political commentator with The Independent. John, thanks for joining us.
Hello there.
Hi. I mentioned the O word there at the top of the programme, omni shambles. Would that be a word that you'd be reaching for tonight?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's much more serious than that. I mean, this isn't just incompetence. This is a huge political and constitutional crisis. And, you know, it's just amazing that we got through the day with Theresa May still Prime Minister. And the reason for that, I think, I mean, very, very good selection of audio clips you had there. But, I mean, she made the absolutely vital point in that clip, which is that nobody else, Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and all the rest of them, nobody else has produced a plan which satisfies the result of the referendum and keeps the Irish border open. She's the only person who's done that, and that's why she's still there, because she's getting flack from both sides, from the people who want to reverse the result of the referendum and for the people who want to go further, but neither of those has actually got a plan that satisfies those two conditions.
But what, I mean, what is the mood there this evening? Where do you think this is going?
Well, it's pretty frantic. It's one of those days where your phone battery is on 3% most of the time. You know, people were talking this morning about whether she could get through the day. There was a sense that it was going to be very difficult. That if a lot of cabinet ministers resigned, then she would have to go. If the 48 letters calling for a vote of confidence in the Conservative Party were announced, then she might be in trouble. But that didn't happen. And, you know, after Dominic Raab resigned, I mean, that seems serious enough, but other people haven't resigned. If Michael Gove had resigned, then, you know, that would be more serious. But she just keeps on plowing on, and she gets quite a lot of credit, I think, for holding a press conference and just taking questions from journalists and standing up there and laying down the line.
But it is the keep calm and carry on British way, is it not? Can I ask you about Michael Gove? You mentioned him there. What's the word this evening on the possibility of his resignation?
Well, It hasn't happened yet. I mean, he is alleged to have been offered the post of Brexit Secretary and turned it down because he would only accept it on condition that he would be allowed to renegotiate the Brexit deal. But that just puts him again in that category of hard Brexiteers who pretend that there's some kind of alternative to what Theresa May has negotiated. As she has said repeatedly, this is the best deal that can be done, you know, within the constraints of the government's position.
And, but I suppose,
you know, Michael Gove doesn't have a better plan. All he could offer would be for us to leave without a deal, and that's not something that would command support in the House of Commons.
Will this deal command support in the House of Commons?
Well, if leaving without a deal would be opposed by a majority in the House of Commons, therefore the consequence of that is that at some point the House of Commons would have to vote for this deal. Now, it doesn't look like that at the moment. It doesn't look remotely possible. But that's partly because the opposition from both sides, from the Remain side and from the hard Brexiteer side, is so vocal and so noisy that you just don't hear the mainstream middle. And yes, Theresa May would need a lot of Labour votes, I think, to offset the hard Brexiteers who would never be reconciled to this and who would rather leave the EU without a deal. But she is going to have to throw herself on the mercy of Labour MPs and say, you cannot be accessories to us leaving the EU without a deal, because you know that will cause huge economic disruption and dislocation.
But of course, she herself threw the third option into the mix last night, not just this deal, no deal, but also no Brexit.
Well, that's the most difficult of the three options, because there really isn't a majority for that in the House of Commons. I mean, I know it's something that my newspaper, The Independent, supports, but that's only going to be an option if we're heading for a no-deal Brexit.
But are we not now heading for a no-deal Brexit? am I reading this wrong? It looks to me on every side that we are heading inevitably almost now towards a no-deal Brexit.
Well, no, because there are always going to be the three options, and the deal that she has negotiated is the middle option. And that's the only place where I can see this going. I mean, I know it looks ridiculous, and I may be going out on a limb here, but I mean, I just cannot see. If it comes down to a choice between the deal and no deal, then people will go for a deal. If it's a choice between the deal and no Brexit, then people will go for the deal. And I just think that is the logic of the situation that people haven't realised yet.
Can you stay with us there for a minute, John? I want to put this to our panel here. Neil Richmond, how are you reading this?
Yeah, I think there was a very interesting comment made there when he referred to the mainstream middle. And that's something, a group of people that's been very quiet in Westminster today. And I think that's noticeable. I suppose this is where it gets a bit strange for those of us on the government side, is we become very much spectators in this whole process, because we can only control the controllables. And so far, the European side has stayed completely solid. The British cabinet has approved this. This now needs to go, from our vantage, to the European Council, the emergency summit on the 25th. And then that then needs us to send it to the European Parliament for assent, the final vote on the 12th and 13th of March. That's where the Irish government has a role now. That's where our focus is. The agreement made between Theresa May's team and Michel Barnier's team earlier in the week, she has taken the commitment that she's going to bring that back. She's got it through cabinet, and she's going to try and get it through Westminster.
Well, she's got it through cabinet, but lost four, you know.
She's only lost two senior ministers, two of her cabinet members, but two juniors.
But she's not just two senior cabinet. One, her Brexit secretary is gone, and it's the second one to go. So, I mean, I'm just wondering, realistically, and I know there's the word out of government buildings all day has been, we believe this can happen, we believe she can do this, she can carry this, but there must be a lot of concern that this is not going to actually get over the line.
But like, what did you expect to happen? Did we think that she was going to leave Brussels, bring the deal back, get it through cabinet, and there wasn't going to be a row? This was
inevitable.
Did you
think she was going to lose her Brexit secretary?
Personally, privately, very much so. To be honest, I thought there'd be one or two more resignations by now, if I'm being honest. And we do have a couple of weeks now before there is actually a vote in Westminster. A lot could happen between now and then. There could be a confidence motion that she defeats. There could be a back me or sack me moment. It's great.
But if she does have a confidence, and even if she does survive, what we hear, she believes she has the numbers to survive a motion if it does get put down. If she doesn't survive it, well, she might as well have gone, because then she's only delaying the inevitable by perhaps weeks, surely.
Not necessarily. We're in unprecedented times. I think someone said that we haven't seen a constitutional crisis like this in the UK since the 1840 Corn Wars. You know, this is new. This is a new departure. This was always going to be big. For the first time ever, a member state's leaving the European Union, not just any member state, the fifth largest economy in the world at the time of their departure, now seventh. And we have to, unfortunately, it's great spectator sport for us, but our role has now moved on to solely the European Council meeting in Brussels on the 25th and then the European Parliament. And hopefully Theresa May sticks to her word and is able to get it through whatever mathematics. I will be watching carefully.
John, what do you think? John O'Brien.
There were three parts to this deal. The first part was the EU-UK negotiation. The second one, the negotiation within the British Cabinet. But by far the most difficult one was always going to be the one to get this deal through the Houses of Parliament, through the Commons. And I watched most of the debate today. The body language, particularly on the Conservative side, was really instructive. There was hardly anybody that was on Mrs. May's side. And I don't think I have ever watched a session in the House of Commons where the Prime Minister seemed so alienated from her own backbenchers. It was really extraordinary to watch. It was one of the most significant days that I've ever watched in London and in Westminster.
Harry, how are you reading this one?
Well, I thought there were a number of significant moments today. I mean, the significant number one for me is that 48 letters have not arrived at the 1922 committee,
right,
which means that the backbencher mutiny read by Blythe Christian himself, Jacob Rees-Mogg, might not materialise into something more serious. I mean, that might change in the coming days. But
and why is that? But I mean, in any normal other political circumstance, a Prime Minister in Theresa May's position, with what has happened, not just in the last 2 days or in the last 2 months, but in the last year, could not possibly survive. And yet there is this reluctance to push her over the cliff.
But there are lots of middle way Conservative MPs who back her, as John was saying earlier on. And what we've heard is the voices of those on the margins who are kind of gouging at the margins, as it were. We haven't heard the mainstream voices. Another significant moment, her moment of weakness. I thought she was quite resolute today. I thought she was, she put in a very strong performance in the Commons. There was one moment of weakness from her, though, that left her slightly as a hostage to fortune when she said that it was a draft, not the final treaty.
Her opening words. Yeah,
yeah, and that just made the wrong signals, and you could hear the mockery
yeah.
Because I mean, the reality is there won't be too much change between this draft and the final treaty that emerges at the end of November.
Paul McAuliffe, do you think our Leo Varadkar and our the government's negotiating team have done a good job on this?
Well, I think the worry is, as we sit here, we still have no backstop, despite that being promised, being cast iron last December. We have no backstop agreed. We have to get an agreement.
We've been hearing a lot of people saying that we will be abandoned. When it comes to the line, we'll be abandoned. And that has not been what has happened.
No, and to be fair, I don't think any Fianna Fáil spokesperson has suggested that the European Union would abandon Ireland. And I think we've been very supportive of the government's position.
I still say the government have done a good job in this, Paul, to be fair. I saw your Brexit spokesperson today, and all she wants to do is get out about the Taoiseach smiling and saying this was a good day in politics. After a torturous 2.5 year negotiation process, the last couple of days have been a massive release and relief, and the government have been more than generous to commend Fianna Fáil and their ALDE relations, to commend Sinn Féin, to commend Brendan Head and the Labour Party and all the Remain parties. This has been a Team Ireland effort. Can you bring yourself to say the government has done a good job, Paul?
But Neil,
can you?
Surely we're far too early to be saying anybody's done a good job.
The controllables, Paul, is what has happened. The government has got an entire 27
points. Okay, let Paul answer whether or not...
We haven't delivered an agreement at this point. It only be the cast iron backstop that was promised last December, that Leo Varadkar said was cast iron, will only become cast iron.
It's in the draft treaty, Paul.
But if there is no deal, there's no cast iron backstop.
But that's not our responsibility. But we've got the European side on pride. Can you bring yourself to say that we've managed to hold together 27 member states, 27 different governments? You can't bring yourself to say it, can you?
I might have to ask you two to take this aside. I want to get back to John Mentel for one moment, because we're wondering now, Boris Johnson, John.
Yes.
Where is he?
Well, his star is fading fast. I mean, you know, there are a lot of Conservative ministers and former ministers who are positioning themselves to succeed Theresa May. It's rather a crowded territory, this, of ministers who've resigned from the government because they're opposed to a Brexit deal, because it's not Brexity enough. So Boris Johnson now has a lot of competition, because that's the sort of territory that appeals, they think, to Tory party members in the country who have the final decision on who the next leader is. And that's the real reason why Theresa May has survived, is because Conservative MPs do not want to hand that decision over to Tory party members, because Tory MPs, you remember, are mostly people who voted Remain. I mean, not hugely. I mean, something like 60-40, I think, they were Remainers. But though, you know, that's enough to keep Theresa May in post, because they are absolutely terrified of what might of who might succeed her.
What about that Sky News poll that we saw today, John? The 54% want Brexit cancelled, 32% in favour of a no deal Brexit. That's a striking number, surely, and just 14% supporting the deal that's actually on the table.
I think that just reflects the noise in the media. Which is that the deal has been castigated from both sides, and again the middle has been rather quiet and subdued about it. And so, therefore, I mean, I don't think people understand the details of, and they don't understand what a no deal Brexit actually means in practice. I mean, I think people just think that sounds like a good clean break that doesn't involve any awkward compromises.
But John, are they not watching the pictures on Sky News of food stocks being stockpiled in warehouses, and you know, is this not putting the fear of God into the?
I mean, the thing is, we political obsessives have to realise how little attention normal people in this country pay to politics, and the subject of Brexit is so tedious and so boring to most people that they have no concept of what politicians are arguing about, and the mere word backstop just guarantees that the people will just switch off and not pay any attention. I mean, what we ought to be talking about is the guarantee of keeping the Irish border open. But you know, I can't persuade.
I think
my
that ship has sailed, John. I think that ship has sailed. I'm going to go now, because we have been joined by Lucinda Creighton, who is, of course, CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former Minister for European Affairs. Lucinda, we've been here trying to pick our way through what may happen next. Okay. Like, what's your read? Do you think Neil is saying this deal isn't necessarily dead? We've got to give her space. She may yet get it over the line. Maybe she will get, you know, the middle ground and Labour Party support for it.
Well, I spent yesterday in Westminster. I've spent quite a lot of time in London in the last few weeks. I certainly am not confident. I wouldn't say the deal is dead. I mean, we have to hope for the best. It's certainly the very best option that that's in front of us right now. It's the only option, and I certainly agree that she needs to be given the space to try to convince, cajole, or worse, as we're well used to in parliamentary politics. But I think her chances are fairly slim, to be honest. You know, if you look at the numbers, even a conservative look at the Tory MPs, both on the Remain side, and there are some of them, believe it or not, and on the the ERG sort of, you know, hardline Brexit side, there are, you know, at least 30 MPs that fall into that category, probably, you know, anywhere up to 60, frankly, and depending where they fall, plus the DUP. So I would say that she's certainly down about 40 votes. She needs 320. And then when you look at the intentions of the Labour Party, those moderate Labour MPs who are prepared to vote for this are very, very few and far between. It's much more likely that she'll get a few pro-Brexit Labour MPs to support it, maybe a handful of others, but it certainly won't come anywhere close to 40. Yeah. There are no, you know, there are no Lib Dems, there are no SNP members of Parliament who are going to vote for it. So it's a huge task, a very, very tall order.
And surely within the sort of atmosphere that's building around it and built around it all day today, that's just going to make everything much harder.
I mean, I think it was entirely predictable. I mean, anybody who thought last night that there wouldn't be resignations today, you know, don't understand British politics. It was inevitable. There probably could be, I think there will be a couple more. You know, the task, I suppose, for Theresa May, and I mean, her approach, and it can be criticised, is very incrementalist. It's, you know, get to step one over and then move on to step two and never really think too far ahead. So her approach at the moment is to, you know, well, was to pretty much ram it through cabinet as she did yesterday and then get to the 25th of November, try and get a nice, you know, sort of warm-hearted political declaration developed this week coming in advance of the 25th and try to sell that as a victory and then come back to Parliament. And that's when the really difficult challenge begins.
If she goes to that summit, with everyone knowing what's facing her in that vote on the way back, I mean, she's going to be in a very impossible position, really, isn't she?
She is. And there was some talk in the last few weeks that, you know, she'd been sort of nearly given an ultimatum that, you know, if she couldn't sort of demonstrate that she could get this through Parliament, then there was no point in bringing a deal to Brussels at all. But I mean, like, that's not the real world. You know, this is politics. It's difficult. You know, we survived the financial crisis, the euro crisis, which was all about, you know, slow steps and compromises. And, you know, I certainly have an office in Brussels. I spend, you know, an awful lot of time there. I have absolutely no doubt that EU leaders want a deal and they will give Theresa May every opportunity to deliver that deal. She's the best hope that they have. Nobody wants to see Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, which is probably what's likely to happen if she loses a vote in Westminster. Nobody wants to see that. That is a much worse scenario. So they will give her every support and everybody will be willing her to succeed. But, you know, they can't do the arithmetic for her, unfortunately.
Paul, I'll let you back in again now. This idea that it's such a politics of negativity, isn't it? It's all the things. The only reason anything will ever move anywhere is because of the terror of the other option.
Yeah, I think Neil was right in many ways that the centre ground politically hasn't been vocal. But I think equally, there's a great tradition in British history that every time the sovereign lost a plot, the baron stepped in. And I think we haven't seen the business community step in. We haven't seen the moderate trade union step in. And I think there's a calculation for that middle ground in Britain to say, do we hold out for a Remain because we want to go back? And I don't think that's possible at this point. Or do we row in behind Theresa May? And
have we given up entirely? We have some form of Brexit one way or another. Does anyone hold out any hope of some set of circumstances that could bring us back to a people's vote?
The difficulty is that the three competing options, for them to be part of a people's vote, I can't see the technical mechanism that allows no deal, a May deal, and then the idea of remaining. I don't even see the technical method of that being put before the people.
There is hope, though. I mean, a constitutional crisis, and let's be clear, that's exactly what is happening at Westminster at the moment, may well produce the circumstances that give us some option to move forward.
Okay, you're going to have to spell that out for us now, because I'm running out of notions of what circumstances are possible.
I think there are only two ways it can come about. It's either a general election or a second referendum, and I think more likely it will be the combination of the two. So it will be a general election, which will be followed by a second referendum. And actually, there's every argument to suggest that a second referendum is really legitimated by, and only legitimated by, a general election. That on its own, it won't be enough because there is so much polarisation.
I think it's a bit more complicated that, John, you lay out some very good options. I really fear a second referendum. All my friends in the UK are calling for a people's vote, but I fear a second referendum could give Leave a mandate for a much harder Brexit, could give a mandate for the no-deal
scenario. But that's not what the polls are showing, surely. I mean, I was looking at the Channel 4 poll, the Sky.
The polls showed that Brexit was going to be defeated. You know, you can't always trust polls. They are very volatile. The appetite for a second referendum, and it brings out the first referendum, when you had one actual option in terms of remaining, you know, the status quo, and a complete utter fantasy option. The prospect, it brought out such a racist, negative campaign from the Leave campaign, littered with mistruths and so much else. I just fear, could you imagine the situation in the second referendum? Brussels won't let us leave.
But there's every argument there saying that Britain has only now, over the last few months, had the debate that it should have had before.
I still think the vast majority of people who voted.
But let's remember, in 2001 and 2008, we had referendums, and we really didn't have the kind of debate that we had in 2002 and 2009. So I think there's every reason to suggest that with the greater degree of information and knowledge that's out there, there could be a much, much better referendum.
We have a smaller, we have a smaller, more kind of collegiate society, and I think that in Britain you're talking about a population that is far more diverse and far more fragmented. If you draw a line across, for say, across Wolverhampton, anywhere north of that, they've most constituencies voted to leave. And if you look at any of the indicators, one of the best indicators is Gogglebox, actually. And if you look at the people from the north who are looking at Gogglebox, when you see anything coming up on Brexit, they're saying, leave already, we want out, we want them. If anything, I think views in terms of Brexit, I think I'd agree with Neil, among certain constituency have hardened anything.
It wasn't one of the big issues in the last referendum was that a huge swathe of voters never voted, that the young vote didn't come out. Yep. And you would have to think that surely what has happened over the last 2 years, that would change in another vote.
You would hope, but in the US midterms last week, where we had some of the same kind of gravity attached to issues, only 30% of millennials actually turned out to vote. And there was a great mobilisation.
Yeah,
it was up very significantly.
I'm still a millennial by year, so I'm delighted to see that on
it. You are the representative. but it wasn't enough, you know, to make that breakthrough against kind of perverse things.
If you use Harry's Gogglebox and analogy, the question is, who's going to leap for Theresa May? Option. So will it be those people who want a Brexit and want it now and want us just to get on with it, and suddenly they're the people who row in behind May? Or will it be the Remain people who feel, look, this is going to be better than a no deal? And I think we're waiting for that shift to happen over the next two or three days in Britain. The question is, will it happen?
She kind of had a veiled threat in her announcement on the doorstep outside Downing Street yesterday, where she, you know, said
no
the
Brexit.
First time. There are three options, not two options, and one of the options is no Brexit at all. That's obviously designed to try to frighten the horses on the Brexiteer side and have them understand that that, you know, if they could have a worse option, they could have a Labour government, they could have a, you know, some sort of circumstances that unfold that would actually prevent the UK.
Well,
it wasn't
just an acknowledgement, really, that the No Deal, which was being wheeled out first as the terrible option, was suddenly realising actually that's the option that a huge number of those Brexiters were actually now hoping for.
Oh, yeah.
So that was
I don't even think they know what they want. I mean, they haven't offered any solutions. They, you know, when you listen to Rees-Mogg or Boris, you know, it's constantly critiquing what's on the table, but never ever putting forward an alternative. And, you know, I think, you know, if Boris Johnson does become Prime Minister, and it's certainly a distinct possibility that would happen even in the next month. You know, what is he going to do between that point
the backstop
and
won't
March?
Be foremost in his considerations. I mean, you can see it's clear from what he has said and what Jacob Rees-Mogg said. They don't really care about
that. Well, no, they don't care at all, but that's the point. I mean, so you know, their only agenda now is to scupper this deal. But what, you know, what do they do actually to make sure that the planes can fly in March?
But when the rumours went out today that Michael Gove was coming to Downing Street, that he was possibly going to take over Dominic Raab's job, the suggestion was that he was also going to be the guy who was going to renegotiate this deal. That is not going to happen. No. Every indication from Brussels today and from national capitals over the last days, there will be no renegotiation. So these people are really living in fantasy.
That was Johnson's great line. When he resigned first, Boris Johnson was convinced, you know what? Make me Prime Minister and I'll get six more months to negotiate a better deal. He talks about the Canada trade deal as one example. I sincerely doubt he's read the Canada trade deal. If he sees how much worse off the UK would be with it, it took 9 years to negotiate. How he's going to do it in 6 months, I haven't a clue.
Okay, I just want to bring a few of the texts because we've been getting quite a few texts in. Theresa May has negotiated a great deal against the odds. Even if she loses a vote of confidence, there is no one who will want to run against her. They lack vision, guile and character. That's from Jerry and Ranla. From Glenda Locke, say what you like about Theresa May, one must admire her for her doggedness, her resolve. In short, one must applaud her leadership. Must we applaud her leadership?
Yes, but Yes, but, you know, so yes, I mean, clearly she has shown tenacity. I think the way she danced her way onto the stage of the Tory conference kind of redeemed her after last year's disaster. You know, she has shown herself to be full of determination. However, you know, the sympathy, you know, people say she's a lonely figure and it must be so difficult. You know, she hid during the referendum campaign. She was a disgrace. She calculated that it would that the UK would vote to stay in. While she was instinctively a Brexiteer, because she had been Home Secretary and she doesn't really like immigrants, she decided to go to ground. She did one press conference on the outer margins of London with, I think, one local journalist showed up, and she did absolutely nothing else to try and avert the disaster that occurred and positioned herself to be leader. So she's in a position that she wanted. She went after it and she got
it. Well, that would indicate that she has very good strategic skills, surely, which would be something
not
you would
what's
require.
Not needed currently.
Okay,
she was John, absolutely dreadful as Home Secretary. She is part of the reason that Britain is in the dilemma that it's in now.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. We'll be back with more on this after these.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannon on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And just to remind you who we have in studio with us, we have Fine Gael Senator Neil Richmond, we have Fianna Fáil Councillor Paul McAuliffe, Lucinda Creighton, CEO of Vulcan Consulting, John O'Brien from Maynooth University, Harry McGee from the Irish Times. And I want to go now to, I want to mention the war. The government need to stop the glory lap and be quiet, as does Fianna Fáil, says a very worried senior public servant. There is a limited to no chance of getting this through the Commons. We are in dark waters and we need to be quiet and let it roll in London and prepare.
I think that was the point I was making when Neil was looking for me to congratulate him. You know, nothing has been agreed at this point.
I said acknowledge it, in fairness, Paul. I don't want congratulations, but there's a very good reason why I'm here tonight and not on Newsnight, and I don't intend to go on it until they vote through it in Westminster.
Well, then why was there that big press conference last night? Why not have stayed in government buildings and put out a two-line statement saying you welcome the developments?
I think
why did you have
to? It was a very significant development. If the Taoiseach of our country and the Taoiseach and the Minister of State with responsibility for European Affairs hadn't come out, taken questions from the media and put through and also explained exactly what was in the 585-page withdrawal agreement and indeed the 8-page political framework, it was vitally important. You can't say, well, the government is okay to hide behind a wall when it suits. It was important that we got out and said exactly.
But did you get the right message out from the way it was reported?
I think there was no.
Did you learn anything from Sputnik the deal earlier
head.
In the year?
I believe that Leo, Simon Coveney, Hal McAtee, I think they've done a very, very, very good job, and I think our diplomats have been outstanding. Absolutely. I really do. So, you know, there's no question about that. But I think that there was certainly an impression created that the deal is done.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know.
Again,
we have a draft and we have a very, very, very long way to go and very choppy waters ahead. So, you know what it reminded me of, because I was there at the time, it reminded me of, I said this to somebody already today, 2012, during the financial crisis, and we were in Brussels at the EU summit, and there was a statement by Angela Merkel, and Enda Kenny and Eamon Gilmore came out and went, you know, just sort of lost the run of themselves and started telling the media that there had been a seismic change and, you know, this was a game changer and so on and so forth. And I remember at the time thinking, oh God, you know, this is just too much. Let's just all cool it and calm down a little bit.
And there were other occasions too. Bertie in 2004, an ode to joy when we're talking about integrated Europe, and there Albert Reynolds waving €8 billion euro in funds. Now, it wasn't quite. I was there last night. It wasn't quite like that. They did try to keep it sotto voce last night, keep it quiet. But at the end, the Taoiseach just couldn't really fully contain himself, and he had to say a couple of. He wasn't being. He was trying not to be triumphalist. But I mean,
it's his default position, Harry.
But it was. I mean, the Irish did get a good deal, but they did. And I mean, if you look at it compared
to
last December,
there must have been a huge relief, as Neil was saying.
They weren't trying to make a big deal of it. Unfortunately, anything that's regarded as a success for Ireland is regarded as a failure for the North. And that's why the DUP jumped on it immediately.
But Harry, the analogy is wrong. We don't have a good deal. We've a good hand of cards, and now we have to have a poker face.
Yeah, but let's remember that we were always, from the very beginning, a prisoner to the relative capacity or political will of the British government to actually deliver on their side of the bargain. And we did everything that could possibly be done. I absolutely agree with Lucinda. Our diplomats have been absolutely outstanding.
Ultimately, last night.
But, you know, there was only so much that we could do. It's actually all about London now.
Ultimately, last
whether they can deliver. Yeah.
Ultimately, last night wasn't a big deal, and nothing will turn it on in the end. It was just
Absolutely,
you know, so
absolutely.
I wouldn't make too much of it.
Exactly. And let's not overstate it. I think it's really important, though, that we manage expectations domestically.
Absolutely, yeah.
Domestically, you know, there is a risk that people think, okay, great, this is sort of a done deal. We have small and medium-sized businesses all over the country that are struggling to prepare for Brexit. They don't have the resources of the large multinationals. This is, you know, this will, you know, if there's a hard Brexit or any disruption to the import export operation, the supply chain operations, either north and south of the border or east west, it is going to wipe out margins and businesses. And businesses need to prepare for it. And if they're told, you know, there's a deal done, don't worry about it, go home, you know, nothing to see here, that's a problem. So we have to be really clear that while a draft is in place and it's a good draft from our point of view, it is but a draft.
The overstatement today was actually by the Examiner and by the Independent, I think, rather than anything that government people did yesterday.
And a good few excited journalists on Twitter last night.
Harry McGee. Were you one of those excited journalists on Twitter?
I probably was, but I'm a journalist. We just can't contain ourselves, you know. We have the same DNA as... But actually, one of the points I wanted to make was, in my estimation, one of the real saboteurs has been the British Labour Party. Mm. I think their strategy has been, you can't even describe it as a strategy, but their behaviour has been disgraceful. Their leader has led by just giving the worst possible example. He has given no direction. He has given no coherence.
But because he's a Eurosceptic and always has been.
He is, but it's a wide church, and there are people in the party who are moderate voices, and they've
been suppressed. Keir Starmer has played.
He has, but he's
as good a hand as he can. I can imagine.
He is moderating, but then he has set out six tests, which to me sound like Gordon Brown's five tests for Britain entering the euro. Impossible to meet under any circumstances. Mm. So Britain, in a way, have sabotaged the process rather than engaging in it. You know, and it's something that has undermined Theresa May, and I think they've been doing it for naked and ambitious political gain more than anything else.
It's a perfect storm. I mean, you know, you on the one hand, you have the sclerotic Conservative Party, which is, you know, it's certainly not recognisable from the Tory Party of even 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, it's just a basket case. But the fact that at the exact same time in British politics, in this moment of, you know, constitutional crisis, as we've just discussed, the Labour Party is in the exact same state, you know. So there's not only a disastrous scenario in the governing party, but there's no opposition either. You couldn't make it up.
The only way that Theresa May will get this deal through Parliament is with the help of what we might call moderate Labour people who used to be called Blairites. Mm. But the bizarre thing is that two interventions in the last few weeks, Mrs. May wrote a remarkable op-ed for The Observer about a month ago, and it was all about trying to peel off 20 or 30 or 40 Labour MPs to her side, moderate, pragmatic people who might have been even conservative. But then last week, Tony Blair wrote a piece for The Observer as well, saying to the very same people, you shouldn't vote for this deal, whatever the nature of it, because it's just not acceptable. And he's been in the media for the last few days saying the same few things. So it is really bizarre to me. I mean, I was really interested that Lucinda said when she was in London yesterday that Theresa May might be 40 votes short, because that's the 40 Labour MPs, as far as I can see.
They're not going to vote.
They're not there, though.
But tell me, what we talked, and everyone has mentioned tonight, this moderate middle ground that are being drowned out by the high-pitched screaming on either side of this. How big is, has anyone polled this? What sense have we got of genuinely that the size of this middle ground that can be carried?
The Guardian produced a very good app this evening where you can see the various calculations Theresa May needs to get this through Parliament in December. And it's all based on such and such a block abstaining, peeling over either the hard Brexit Labour MPs like Kate Hoey, or appealing to the moderate Labour MPs who are just utterly opposed to Jeremy Corbyn, like Lisa Nandy, or maybe even Owen Jones, who's still bitter after being sacked from the front bench. And then what I thought was interesting actually today, when people, John said there was an hour before anyone spoke up for Theresa May, but the first person to speak up, by my calculation, you might were watching a bit closer, was Amber Rudd. You know, and she's, and then Nicky Morgan followed her as well. So those are two people she had sacked from cabinet who were arch Remainers, who were not necessarily in the people's vote wing, but very much the One Nation Tory. So,
but they were two lone voices.
Two lone voices, but they weren't even that supportive. I thought they were neutral.
Well, they're both. I know both of them, and I think they're both very angry about where the party is and where they find themselves. And you can even see it in their Twitter feed. You know, they both kind of explode from time to time. But I mean, they are loyal to her, and they know that there's no other deal. So they're pragmatic, you know.
OK, one last question has come in on a text as well. Would Europe allow the UK back at no cost?
I think the European Union will allow an extension if there is a real constitutional crisis in London. But to suggest that Britain leaves after the 29th of March and then comes back, that is not going to happen unproblematically. There is an accession process. It's a very detailed one. The UK would have to agree to join the euro, for example, the Schengen zone. Completely.
But I do think there's an appetite, John.
Most British people.
And I get your point and I fully agree with you, but there is also the cancellation or the revoking.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. Like that's obviously you're gone and there's a whole you start off again. Yeah, but if you don't actually get to March.
Definitely from an Irish perspective, and I've said this to colleagues, people that listen to it know well in the EPP, I'd have them back in tomorrow. You know, you have to have them back in to have the nice.
I think that would be the consensus, to be honest.
I don't know anyone in Europe.
That's all.
We're one week on now,
and we're probably closer to no deal this week than we were last week. And there is the question about our preparedness for that. And even at an industry by sector question, Dublin City, how prepared are we to handle a no deal Brexit? And I think we've a lot of questions ahead on that.
Okay, and we'll have those another night because I need to take a break now, but we're going to come back after this break and talk about Padraig Tobin.
Tweet at Late Debate RTE. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're very welcome back. Now, today, Padraig Tobin walked out of Sinn Féin after 21 years with the party. Earlier on Drive Time, Padraig Tobin told Mary Wilson why he did it.
Over the last 18 months or so, I haven't had a fair chance with regards representation in the party. I had a written deal with the party up until that period of time to say that I wouldn't be held back or marginalised in any way. And from about mid-2016 onwards, literally that changed, and I wouldn't have had access with regards portfolios, spokespersons' positions, media engagements, etc. And I felt that I was being held back with regards myself representing the people of Meath West, and that's no good for them, and it's no good for me as well.
Harry McGee, this wasn't exactly a massive surprise today, was it?
No, not really. It's the second time that he has been suspended. This time it's for 6 months. I think his concern was that if a general election were to be held, that he would have to stand as an independent and then reapply for admission to the Ord Cuirlia. And he'd be in the kind of the Jacob Rees-Mogg territory of a vassal state. He'd be depending on the largesse of the Sinn Féin Ord Cuirlia. So that was unacceptable to him. But Padraig Tobin and Sinn Féin have been diverging from each other for the past couple of years. Since 2013, since he voted against the party in the Protection of Life During Pregnancy bill. Now, he has tried without avail to get the National Conference, the Ord Eisteddfod Sinn Féin, to agree to a freedom of conscience vote, and that has been rejected. So the Sinn Féin applies a very strict whip to all its votes, be they conscience votes, whereas the other major parties allow a conscience vote. Fine Gael, as Lucinda will remember. Used to, but it
did in the last.
That was a big mistake. You know, I mean, it was. I think they learned a lesson from that,
yes,
and have now apply it. So Carl Nolan went earlier on this year. They just found that the party no longer accommodated their views, and I'm sure the party feels the same. I mean, Mary Lou McDonald's and Michelle O'Neill's the speeches from them today, or the comments from them today, were hardly what you might expect for somebody who had served the party for so long.
Well, we can put that now to Sinn Féin TD for Waterford, David Cullinan. We have you on the line. Are you there, David?
I am, Katie. How are you?
I'm very well. And that line, I mean, do you think that Sinn Féin has done right by Padraig Tobin?
Well, first of all, I'm saddened that Padraig has left because he was a friend of mine as well as a colleague, and I served for a long number of years in Leinster House, and I knew Padraig long before we were both elected to Leinster House. So it's obviously sad when anybody leaves the party, and that's a matter that Patter has made for himself. He made the decision to leave. It's a source of regret, obviously, when somebody leaves, and Patter is somebody of enormous talent, somebody I have respect for, somebody who has deep values, and somebody who hopefully I will continue to work with, and many of my colleagues in Sinn Féin will continue to work with, despite the fact that he is now outside the party.
But I was listening to him this evening talking about the fact that he had a written agreement. He said the party had unilaterally walked away from that, and that he has been marginalised within the party. Like, Patrick Tobin would have been a very senior figure and would have been seen as a big flag bearer for Sinn Féin. And it's extraordinary to hear that this is what has been going on behind closed doors.
Well, first of all, I don't accept that Patter was marginalised. And if you look back over the course of the last campaign, Patter was very vocal. Patter took part in a huge number of debates, very prominent debates on RTE. Patter was not sanctioned for taking part in any of those debates, and the party leadership made it very clear that Patter and any other member of the party were entitled to express their own personal opinion. But the party membership, as Harry pointed out, made a decision that when the people speak, and the people spoke in very large numbers on this issue, that we have a responsibility to enact laws. And the responsibility for all Sinn Féin TDs is to make sure that we vindicate the views of the people as expressed at the ballot box and in the referendum, and 66% of the people voted to change the laws.
But David, do you not recognise that this has moved on within all the other parties, that there is a recognition that there are, you know, rare but occasional issues that are matters of conscience, and that it is an enormous price you're paying yourselves for throwing a TD of that calibre overboard in order to just hold the party line? I mean, is there this authoritarian streak within Sinn Féin that demands absolute loyalty to every policy point?
But hang on a second, it's not authoritarian, it's democracy. The party membership debated this issue for 3 decennia, and motions were put down to allow people to have a free vote on a number of issues, including issues such as this. And the party membership said no, because party democracy has to prevail, but also democracy has to prevail. And we have a job beyond our own personal views when we go into the Dáil Chamber. We are not elected as independents. We are elected as Sinn Féin representatives to represent Sinn Féin policy. Sinn Féin policy is enacted at the Ardèche. But the bigger point here is that we had a referendum campaign. And in that campaign, people expressed all of their opinions. Patter was free to express his opinion. The people voted overwhelmingly to change the law, 64%, I think, in Patter's constituency. And our party membership and our party leadership expects all of our TDs and senators to make sure that we vindicate that election result and that and the result and the will of the people. And I think that's appropriate. I think it's right. And I think it's the right decision.
David, Mary Lou MacDonald is having a fairly rough honeymoon period, is she not? I mean, there's no denying the presidential election strategy was a disaster. And now this.
No, I don't accept that, and I think she's popular. She's popular in Sinn Féin, she's popular outside Sinn Féin. Obviously, the result of the presidential election is not what we wanted. We would have wanted a better result, but we took a gamble, we took a risk, we contested the election because we felt it was the right decision. I think it's always good for political parties to put their views before the people to contest elections. I think she is a very strong leader, a very capable leader, and one who has the support of the vast majority of the members and the supporters of Sinn Féin. So I wouldn't read too much into that. Obviously, it's a sad occasion when a TD leaves the party, and that's not something that we want, but that's up to Patter.
I want to ask Paul McAuliffe here, could Sinn Féin's loss be Fianna Fáil's gain?
Well, first of all, I have to say, from a distance, I've obviously admired Patter, and like many articulate and intelligent people, he's obviously struggled against the centralised control within Sinn Féin. What I was interested in when he spoke today about the three things that he wanted to build this new platform on, being a 32-county Ireland, the idea of economic justice and small enterprise, and space for those people with different views. Like, that sounds very much like Fianna Fáil.
Would he be welcome?
Well, anybody is welcome to join Fianna Fáil, but you also have to earn your place in Fianna Fáil before you would represent the party. But Katie, there was a lot of navel-gazing around Fianna Fáil during the referendum. So far, Fine Gael has lost a TD and Sinn Féin has lost two TDs.
We didn't lose solely about the referendum.
And Fianna Fáil has lost no TDs. And you have to give credit to Micheál Martin on two issues. One was for leading a lot of the centre ground on the issue of the Eighth Amendment. And the second was for him giving space for people, because you can't force people to believe something that they don't believe.
What we do know from what just David, I want to ask Lucinda, because Padder did say today that he is in contact. He's going to travel the country for the next month. Seemed to be hints that he was thinking perhaps about some sort of party or put some other name on it. You have been down this road before, Lucinda, and I mean, we discovered, I mean, we all can see from the referendum result there is a third of people who have a pro-life position and will vote for that in a referendum, but will they vote for a pro-life party? And the experience of Renew suggests they won't.
Well, when I led Renew, it was a party which allowed freedom of conscience, which every other party subsequently followed, or almost every other party, as we learned from Sinn Féin.
It did attract representatives of and candidates of a pro-life persuasion.
It did, and it attracted plenty of people who weren't, which was the whole point. That wasn't the platform upon which we campaigned. I don't really think that people define their politics in that context. Personally, I think that, and actually, if you look around Europe and you look around the developed world, parties of all hues always allow space for people to have views, particularly on issues relating to the right to life and to follow their conscience
here,
in that regard.
As I have you here, and I'm sure Padder will be wondering, have you a bit of advice for him?
I could say
you offer him a job.
it's very, very tough. I mean, our electoral laws and our funding laws make it almost impossible to set up a new party. That's the first thing. It's a very closed shop. It's actually anti-competitive, as we discovered. So it's very, very difficult to get on the pitch and to fund a new political operation. I'm a real believer in choice and democracy and giving people an opportunity to have, you know, plenty of options at the ballot paper. So, you know, I have no difficulty if people want to get involved in setting up new political movements and parties. I think it's a healthy thing, and I don't see why there should be resistance to it.
Has Padder been speaking to you?
No, I haven't seen Padder Tobin since I was a member of the Dáil. But I respect him. I think, you know, he's somebody who knows his own mind. I have great respect for him, actually. And I think it's really, I think the idea of parties imposing whips on issues of conscience, you know, we're the only country in the world where this happens. It's absolutely outrageous. I mean, it's just bizarre.
OK, David, I'll let you back in there.
Very quickly, Paul from Fianna Fáil talked about centralised control. And that's a bit rich, given that only last week two of his senior representatives were chastised for holding a selection convention in the north. So all parties have rules, and rules have to be followed. And I make the point again that the vast majority of the members of Sinn Féin took a vote at an Ard Fhéidh that Sinn Féin representatives would have to go with the party policy and vindicate party policy, but more importantly, vindicate the results of a referendum. That's what TDs are elected to do.
Okay, David, we're right up against the clock here. Thank you for that. You get the last word. Just a few of the tomorrow's headlines. The Irish Examiner has gone with defend Brexit deal from collapse. That's Simon Coveney today. The Times, the London Times, lonely May staggers on. Theresa May in front of all the British papers today. Resignations, a coup and a day of hostility, but May fights on, says The Guardian. The Daily Telegraph, am I going to see this through? Yes, I am. And the Financial Times, May defiant as draft deal threatens Tory civil war. And tonight's programme, that's all for tonight, I'm afraid. I want to thank my panel and our guests on the phone line. Tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. And Ruth Kennington was on sound. Now it's over to Cathal Murray on Late Date.